actually, I think it was mostly good conversation until we talked about how Fergal loves that volleyball scene in Top Gun. But that's okay. We can come back to that later.
I mean, yeah, the setting is different. The characters are different. I mean, one's white, one's Asian. So we'll start there and work our way outwards from that point of view.
Hello and welcome to Movie
Smash!
Hello and welcome to Movie Smash, the show where we dive headfirst into comic book movies outside the MCU. If you're new to the show, thanks for joining us. If you've been here before, you know the drill. Each episode, we're going to smash a movie whose source materials from a graphic novel or a comic. Is it worth revisiting? Should it be forgotten? Let's find out. This is Movie Smash. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Roberts. I'm the founder of All Panel Creations. With me today, I have a man whose only suit is a mech suit, Jeremy Parmentier.
Hey, this is Jeremy Parmentier, also of the Retrovaniacs podcast. And I learned today that this movie is not the movie Oblivion.
Well, that is quite true. Also with me today, a man who often feels like he's living the same day over and over again, Fergal Amayo.
Yes, this is Fergal Amayo, a.k.a. Rita Verdun, Rita Vitasky, a.k.a. the Angel of Verdun, a.k.a. the founder of Gotham Knight Comics, a.k.a. the man who is living the same day like it's Groundhog Day. Let's get into it, and let's not try to fall into a trap while we do it.
And our guest this evening is Braxton Cosby. Braxton, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, guys. I'm here to talk about movies and plots and just have a great time with you all.
Kazi, you join us from, your own studio, Kazi Media Productions?
Yep, Kazi Media Productions. We're a small press publisher. We've been publishing since 2014. We published over 30 authors with 60 different titles and ebooks, audiobooks, and paperbacks. We feel as if our jam is fantasy and science fiction, because that's my great love. And so that's pretty much what we do a lot of our publishing with. But we also do a lot of nonfiction. We do poetry. We do autobiographies, self-help and inspirational. And in 2021, we actually started our own comic book imprint called Starchild Comics. And since then, we have published over 12 issues. So a lot of great storytelling.
Oh, fantastic. But the movie tonight that you picked was 2014's Edge of Tomorrow, starring Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt, Brenda Gleeson, and directed by Doug Liam. Liam? Lehman.
Lehman.
Lehman? Are you sure? Okay, we'll go with that.
What day is it?
Judgment Day. You just came in with the fresh recruits.
This is not the end.
The invasion will fail, along with every soldier you are sending. We lose everything.
Come find me when you wake up.
You do know what's happening to me.
What happened to you happened to me.
Braxton, like I said, you picked this movie for us. Why did you choose it?
It's one of my favorites. I know that we have some real Tom Cruise fans on the chat tonight, but I'm actually a fan of Tom Cruise as well. I think he puts a lot of effort into his films, whether it's just the acting or the storylines. It always seems to be very solid. I'm a good Mission Impossible fan. I loved Oblivion, and I also loved Edge of Tomorrow.
Guys, this book started originally as a light novel, which then became a manga, which now becomes this movie. And my daughter, who used to be a huge manga fan, explained to me a lot of times these mangas start as these light novels. But either way, are any of you familiar with this piece of literature?
No, not. And it's interesting because I'm not a manga person. I like certain manga. Again, I'm kind of pretty old school. There's some stuff I kind of do like, but no, the first time I got introduced to this, honestly, I thought this was original material. It wasn't until you brought it up in this that I just thought this was an original Tom Cruise movie. That's what kind of like Oblivion, kind of different storylines. I was like, okay, this is him doing one of his pet projects.
Oblivion's a comic too, by the way.
See? That probably some crazy shit that nobody reads.
Yeah, I also didn't know this was based on anything other than that it was a movie. But now that I know that, there's lots of things that click and it make more sense, like the Emily Blunt's character having that big sword and some of the fight sequences and things were like, okay, that definitely fits. I can see that. But yeah, I as I kind of hinted earlier, I thought I saw this movie before, and I may have, but it's not the movie I thought I was going to watch. That said, it was still kind of very similar to the movie I thought I was going to watch. But it does have that definite anime feel to a lot of the action scenes, and the I mean I do like that to Braxton's point, the title change is unfortunate. I think Edge of Tomorrow is a good title. That's like if Star Wars was just called Luke Skywalker's Dad Gets Angry, right? So that you don't want that. You don't want that kind of title.
Drop it right on the nose.
Luke Skywalker's Dad Gets Angry Part 2 and Strikes Back. That's perfect.
It sounds like for you guys, this was not your first time seeing this movie, except maybe you, Jeremy.
No, Jeremy just confused it with Oblivion, right? You just like, you thought this was Oblivion. You were like, okay, let me strap in for Oblivion, and it wasn't.
Yeah, but it has some similar feel. And I don't think I'm the only person who's made that mistake. If you hadn't seen either one in a long time, they aren't interchangeable movies by any means, but they're from the same time frame. They both have Tom Cruise. They're both this kind of sci-fi thing with some sort of like rebirth piece to it. So I do see how I made that confusion. But also, as we've learned on this podcast, I'd say 90% of our movies, I think, are different movies till we watch them. So,
well, Jeremy, it makes sense you made that confusion because Cruise actually finished filming for Oblivion and then immediately went into filming this movie. They were made essentially back to back.
That would make sense. He was ready to go. And that might be just his process. I think this is all prep up for the next Mission Impossible movie.
Maybe. But Fergal, do you have any history on this comic at all?
I'm going to say the name horribly. Written by Ryosuke Takeuchi. Ooh, I did pretty well. Written by Hirohoshi Sakazuki, the light novel. Illustrated by Yoshitoshi Abe and published by Shishura. It was actually optioned. It was published in 2014, and it was optioned the same year. So, I mean, that's pretty unheard of in the industry, unless it's something extraordinary. So, you know, and clearly this movie doubled its investment at the theater, but more importantly, this is one of the Tom Cruise movies that's gone into kind of some cult status a little bit because it's a really cool story.
So if this is your first time joining us, just a quick heads up. We're going to be discussing certain elements of the story that might be considered spoilers for essentially what is Groundhog Day meets Starship Troopers. So consider yourself warned. So Braxton, do you want to give us a quick synopsis of the movie? Like what happens?
Oh yeah, sure. Tom Cruise's character, Major Cage, he's just a public relations officer in the movie. He's in the military. You know, Earth is under siege by these aliens called Mimics. And they essentially keep getting wiped out, but, you know, through the repeat that we have. And then when Tom Cruise is sent out to the front line, like I say, he's not a soldier. And he gets out there and all of a sudden he gets killed, but he gets connected to one of the Mimics. So he ends up having to get this whole repeat thing over and over again. He lives through the same sequence of events. He has to figure out, you know, how he's going to change his outcome by kind of figuring out he's going to have to be a soldier. So he connects with Emily Blunt and they have this great relationship. It's basically essentially what we writers call a fish out of water. You know, he's definitely not the hero, but he becomes a hero through, a lot of ups and downs and challenges and confrontation and conflict. So it's essentially the hero story of the anti-hero, fish out of water kind of combination with a nice little B story between him and Emily Blunt. So I dug it. I thought it checked all the boxes.
I think the director, when he was interviewed about it, was saying that it was fun doing this with Tom Cruise because it's basically a movie where Tom Cruise isn't good at anything at first, unlike most of his other movies where Tom Cruise is always the best.
Right. And then when he starts getting it, man, it's, like I said, just remind me of being a gamer. Just remind me of a video game. I'm like, oh, now he gets, you know, you get that whole sequence of playing a game over and over again. It reminded me of like Contra back in the day. You just had to memorize where everybody was and you start shooting and you know the weapons that you want to get through certain levels on the board. So it kind of paid homage to that for me.
Yeah, I've been recently playing the game Silk Song and it kind of reminds me of that. Just beaten to a pulp over and over again until it finally clicks.
Right.
So how'd you guys feel about the character Cage, Tom Cruise?
Oh, man, he was kind of cool. I thought if you think about the character he's supposed to be based off in the light novel in the anime, I think when you think about kind of the emotions they're trying to channel, because remember, it's a book, so you're trying to translate a book to a comic anyway. I think they did a good job paying enough homage while completely changing the story and changing the ending, which was crazy. And I think I just think Tom Cruise can't help but do a good role.
I don't think you're supposed to like Cage at first. I mean, because he's kind of this, you know, he's as you mentioned, kind of a PR person. So he's a military officer, but he's, you know, he's out there talking a big game. But then when it comes down, he's like, oh, I don't do combat. That's not what I'm going to do. So when he gets sent out there, he like basically just kind of disrespects the whole army in that process by saying, I'm not going to go out. I'm not going to do this. And so he gets court-martialed essentially and forced to go as a new recruit again. which I thought was a cool spin. And then the whole, you know, concept of the, as we mentioned, is the fact he kept living the same day, reliving the same day over and over again, a Groundhog Day style. And I liked the, I did like the gradual like changeover of him from being this guy who clearly doesn't want to be there or trying to find ways to get himself out, not to make this a success, but how to get out to where eventually he becomes, like, through dying hundreds and thousands of times, this super soldier. And it's a gradual, like, he doesn't even look big and bulky at the beginning, but by the end, he definitely looks kind of ripped and he knows how to use those suits and he's really got it down. Like, I liked the transition of Cage, but you're not supposed to like him at first at all.
Yeah, I definitely think he went through a great story arc. You know, essentially the hero story is always you pick somebody, they make a decision after the inciting incident. And obviously for him, it was being thrown into the battle and dying. That was an inciting incident. And now he's got to figure it out. And he's in this loop that he really doesn't want to be a part of. But if he keep, but as he keeps dying over and over again, he's like, man, I essentially have to figure this out because I don't like dying. And then he actually sees the bigger picture is that obviously the world is going to be wiped out if he doesn't figure out how to change this. So the essential hero story is they have the inciting incident that starts them on a journey. They make the decision to go on the journey, and then they're never prepared to beat the antagonist in the beginning. They have to do something along the way to train, so it feels really earned. Obviously, if he got to the main mimic and killed him in the beginning, you really don't have much of a story. So you want to see this gradual ebb and flow, up and down. That didn't work. Let me see if I can figure this out. Nope, that didn't work. Let me see if I can figure this out. And you keep making all these decisions along the way. And then essentially when you get to the end, we know that he has, like you say, he's mastered the use of these machines, the technology. He understands the enemies like the back of his hand. And now the payoff is there when he pulls off what he needs to at the end to essentially, you know, try to save humanity. So I felt it was really earned. And along the way, we had a lot of great action sequences and special effects were amazing. So it gave me all the elements that I needed to give it a thumbs up, you know, essentially for a great story.
Well, and keep in mind that it also hit on the alien, the mimic component. I think making that an equally intriguing story from how they went and tracked that thing is equally badass.
His co-star, Emily Blunt, star is Rita, who plays also the Angel.
Rita Vitasky. Yeah, she's actually, you know, her and her husband, boy, they are some fit people. She was really in shape for this movie.
Yeah.
No doubt.
Sort of. Well, the mechs that they're wearing, they're actual real. They're not CGI. And Tom Cruise requested that. And they're about, I think it said it was like 80 or 90 pounds. When she first put that suit on, she cried. It was so heavy. And Tom Cruise actually in that moment, and this is, you can read up on it. He says this in interviews all the time, that Tom Cruise gave her a very sort of straightforward, words of encouragement that pushed her through it. And she said it made her a better actress because this is her first gigantic movie. Yeah. And his words were, don't be a pussy.
Sounds about
well,
right.
You know, that's right to the point.
That sounds Tomish.
That's gotta be, that's why, again, my wife makes fun of me all the time for this. I can have the Tom Cruise bromance. I just don't have to have a long-term conversation with him. That can get me into trouble.
Other notable characters in the movie, Bill Paxton plays Master Sergeant.
Yes, he does. Isn't it John Farrell? What's his name? John Farrell?
It's Farrell Ferris. He says it over and over again because of the repeat of the day thing. But I liked his character because it's not, he clearly, you know, he has the same speech every day, but you know, you keep seeing Cage like fill in the words and he knows what he's going to say and whatever. And he's kind of taken aback by it. But also any movie like this where Bill Paxton's in it, I just think of Aliens and that's always a win. But he's good because he's important to the early part of the movie, but he's not like a main character that pushes it forward. After you kind of get Cage with Rita, he kind of fades out a little bit. He's still there in the background, but he's not doing anything to move the movie forward or not.
No, yeah, no, but I mean, but it's Bill Paxton, so you can yes, always live with a little bit more Bill Paxton.
Oh yeah, and how do you guys feel about J Squad?
J Squad's interesting. I wonder how those folks would do on any other project. I mean, clearly the military is, because I'm a Navy guy, it's all about throwing people who don't really work together. But I wonder how these guys would do on a voluntary project.
Like, it makes you kind of wonder, like, how this group came together to become J Squad, like. I mean, they all have like their little backstories that we hear about as they go along. But like logistically speaking, like I could not imagine that being a good idea, sticking those people all in one room.
Well, this is bodies. This movie came out around D-Day. So, and obviously the invasion in France and the takeover of all of Europe, that's really meant to resemble the D-Day invasion. So that's kind of why that came to fruition. But I mean, it's, remember, that was all bodies. If you go back historical record on that, you can, they just had to pummel the line.
The scene of them taking the beach is supposed to be, you know, directly pulled from D-Day. In fact, the movie came out on the 75th anniversary of D-Day.
I'm going to bring those steelbook facts.
I actually don't have this as a steelbook, Virgil.
This is my steelbook of Tom Cruise. Come on, let's bring it.
Yeah, you need a steelbook collection of everything he's ever been in. But we kind of hinted at different scenes. So why don't we just jump straight into this movie? So you've all sort of talked about it. It starts off with him doing a bunch of PR for the Army. And then he goes to meet with a general of the actual...
The new jacket technology.
Yeah. And he's meeting with the general for some reason. The general wants to meet with him. And he's like the general of all the armed forces from all the countries about to do this giant invasion. Did this... obviously, this whole point is to give you a little exposition on what's happening. Do you feel it was heavy-handed, or did you feel like they actually did a good job of explaining the premise of this movie?
They had to. You had to, because it wasn't just a single... This is 5 years these mimics have been raging across Europe. And they're getting ready. I mean, they demonstrated that they're just at England's door. So that's the last, this is like the last big push before they cross the U.S. And I think that's where they're kind of just like, you know, this is where they're trying to take a, you know, united defense situation. You know, that's where, I mean, that's, again, that's part of the reason where they, the comic and this, they kind of come really nicely together. Even the Cage story, it all kind of comes together, but you have to sort of give a background if you want this to make sense. If you want to care about where they're at in the desperation.
Yeah, I think essentially, like you said, to his point, it's just about bodies. So it's about just throwing, I mean, J-Squad, I don't know what their history is and what they've ever successfully done before. But this is obviously just like, hey, we're going to throw what else we have left. Because again, to your point, if this has been 5 years, we're probably down to the last little bit of what's left. You know what I mean? So I'm sure there was a squad who tried to take these things on initially, and they got it obliterated too. So now we're down to J, and it's like, okay, just throw another one of these out here, because nothing we're doing is going to work anyway. And that's essentially what they have to realize, the reason why nothing worked, you know?
I don't think it's anything that's going to work. They believe this is the fine. This is what they need to do to win because of the previous attempts that they don't, they kind of get into the background of a little bit with that Rita's character.
Rita Vitasky?
Got the name. Yeah, where she got the name, the Angel of Verdun.
That's where the whole, that's Gage did that. And that's saying the limited training in the new jacket technology, that was all the mimic's effort to lure everyone into the final resistance and knock everyone out at the same time.
Right. So they think this is like their last push where they're going to win. So I don't think they think it's not going to work. I think they're doing everything they can, because it's like, this is our last chance. We have to make this work, but this is the right chance. Like, this is what we've learned with these previous, you know, this previous win. They know now that there's, you know, probably some overlord that if they can get rid of it, they can, you know, they can find a way to win. So they're going where they think it is in France, and they're throwing everyone they can at it. That's why they brought him in as well. Even though he's not a combat veteran, they're like, too bad. You're right. You have a uniform. You're going.
It just seems I understand what the premise was. These mechs are trying to basically make the average person a killing machine, but it seems like it's such a waste of money to stick it on this guy to throw him at, because he doesn't survive very long. When he hits the beach, how long does he survive when he gets to the beach for the first time?
Oh, like 15 seconds, 20 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah, second. And then he's running around a hole with J-Squad. And they're like, what the hell? Who'd you say this guy was? Yeah. I mean, so like the evolution. Do you know, actually, the writer of the YA novel on this actually thought about, same with the guy who did the anime, they both had their distinct thought of going back and looking at games where you continually repeat and reprint character to get better. And that's how they directed it. That's the angle that they took. Even though the original guy who did this book kind of thought of Groundhog Day, he really did think about the reset button on a video game to say, well, what if that's where we start our story?
There is no point in the movie where they say the how many cycles he's been through.
No.
But if you had a hazard guess, how many times do you think he's lost his life?
Probably 300. Probably at least thousands. 300. I mean,
thousands.
Do you really think thousands? I mean, because yes. I wondered that, and I actually looked into the YA on that. There wasn't thousands. It was a lot, though. It was a lot. It was hundreds. So, I mean, I don't know, you know, because I've been rereading the Berserker comic series. I don't know if you guys know that. That's a really interesting telling of an immortal and how many times he dies and what he has to go through in order to be immortal forever. I mean, I don't know, man. What does that do when you die thousands of times? Do you even care about the people you're saving?
It's not just that he gets the training, because he's got to live one day essentially at a time over and over again to get this training, but he's has to memorize where all these different people move. And every time he makes a mistake, and they show those, Every time he makes a step forward, it's like you watch him fail 10 to 15 times. And then even when you're watching them succeed, Rita will ask him, she's like, well, wait, how many times have we done this before? And he's like, hundreds. Like, you know, like he's telling her after they're getting successfully farther in the long run that you more or less watch, that he's done this so many times, it's countless times. He's tired, he's worn out, he doesn't know, you know, what else to do. When he finally gets to the point where it's like, well, I've never gotten this far before, he doesn't know what to do. But I think it's been thousands of times. Maybe not, but I imagine it's countless times.
Yeah, I mean, every decision, it might be a dozen attempts, right? Every time, because there are points where he's like, well, we've got to wait 30 seconds. Now we can go forward.
Knowing is a similar movie, the movie called Knowing. No, not Knowing. What is the movie? Oh, it's a Nick Cage movie where he can see all the different futures. That's a different movie. What is the Nick Cage movie where you can see everybody's different future? His own.
Ghost Rider. It's Ghost Rider.
No, it's not Ghost Rider. Now you're just throwing me off completely. And then there's a, now you've just completely thrown me off. Now all I can think about is Ghost Rider. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome.
I appreciate that. Damn it.
Well, the interesting thing was that, and my son brought this up when we watched his movie together, is that he keeps resetting, but there's no sleep, right? There's no time in which he actually rests. He's got to be going mad through this whole thing.
Maybe not. You don't know if it's that he rests or not. Maybe that when he dies, it's who knows how long he could be unconscious, but it doesn't matter. It's a restart. So it's he's exactly as awake as he was the first time he wakes up.
That's exactly what makes this movie infuriatingly crazy, because to your point, if he has been dying, Jeremy, thousands of times, you're waking up with the exact level of awareness that you started that day with, knowing that you're dead. And you died the day before and the day before and the day before that and over again.
Well, and there are a couple of times where he gives up, but takes a break from the whole thing.
When he's in London, when he has a drink and they cross the straits and they start attacking London, that's probably the most profound, because he knows what's going to happen and he still just sits there and has a drink.
Well, I think it's kind of like he's now realized that if they do, when they fail, what's actually going to end up happening.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he maybe just wants that moment, you know, that's anchor to humanity moment that I think a lot of great stories have. Like, I talk about this all the time. Like, when you're writing, you can have a cool character and it could be amazing and lovable and all of that. But if you don't connect them to humanity, you're going to lose a lot of the audience. So you figure out these things that you can do to make them really, really essentially favorable. And so you see it in something like The Mandalorian. Mandalorian was great. Star Wars is just always a great vibe, regardless of which, if you don't put a bunch of jokes in it and make it silly like they do more than half the time, you already have the world established. People like Star Wars because of the world. And so you make The Mandalorian, he looks cool, he's great, great action sequences and all that. And then essentially, that show picked up and took off the minute they brought in Baby Yoda, aka, you know, Grogu, because that was something that anchored The Mandalorian to humanity. That made him something that we can really feel and understand, because essentially, at some point in your life, whether you have kids or not, you understand having to take care of something. Maybe you're just a pet lover and you have pets that you take care of. Or maybe it's a little brother, little sister, you know, or maybe somebody just took care of you all your life. You understand that dynamic and you connect to that character. So it's the same way with Tom Cruise. He was doing all these things, trying to reset, figure things out. And then eventually, you know, we don't know anything about his family. We don't know anything about kids and things like that. At least we don't see them. So it's like, well, how do I connect to him? Well, you know what? He goes and he grabs a drink and he's like, screw this, you know? And I think that's like, okay, now we can dig in a little bit here and see a real person just having a real moment where it's like, whether I do anything or not, it's probably not going to work. So let me just have a moment here, take a beat and just do something really normal. And I think that probably connected him in a subtle way to a lot of people. And I think it was just the writer's way of taking a moment to step back out of the story for a second and say, hey, man, let's do something essentially that people can relate to and understand.
They did the same thing in the helicopter crash in that scene. They did the exact same thing. They paid homage to the love that Cage, who's completely played different character, Kiju Kara, whatever, in the manga or the YA, to this one. I think that the relationship between the two of them, where they can't get past that one place with the helicopter and he ends up going to the dam by himself, I think that's another side of him. That also shows how tired he is at the same time.
That was actually going to say the same thing. Those are both very similar, right? The first one is him saying, you know, needing to take a break, but deciding like, well, maybe it doesn't matter if we win or lose this. Maybe it won't really be that bad. You don't know if he's saying that or not, but that's something you might be thinking. So you get that scene, you see that, no, it is going to be that bad. You see them coming through the water. They're going to kill everybody. It's as horribly as everyone died on the battlefield, but these are just regular people. So he's like, okay, well, now it does matter. This kind of resets him and keeps him focused. And then when he realizes ultimately, like, no matter how many times he's run through this, they've tried 100 different things or however many times they've done this for the helicopter, and he keeps failing over and over again. He's like, you know what? I'm just going to do this on my own. I know what to do now. I can get there. You know, if I die in the process, who cares? Because I'll save this other person. I will save this unit. I'll save the world, but not like, and become the hero everyone's going to remember. No one's going to remember him at all, but he doesn't care anymore. He's done this enough times. He sees what happens. He's just going to do whatever he can to try to help as many people as possible and maybe get this done.
Now, through these flashbacks, these cycles, we start learning the rules of the game. And there are some interesting rules to this, to his immortality, essentially, or this time travel. One of which is he must actually die.
Yes.
Yes.
And like she was saying, like, if you break a leg, make sure you're killed.
The blood transfusion, it's not the death. It's just the fact that the thing that was really different from the manga is that they took out, like, in the manga, you didn't lose the power with the transfusion. You had the power. Actually, there was a much more gruesome way you had to resolve that situation. And that's where the manga veers off in its own completely different ending.
What's the, not the ending. We'll save the ending for a bit. But up to this point, Fergal, have there been major differences between the manga and the movie?
I mean, yeah, the setting is different. The characters are different. I mean, one's white, one's Asian. So we'll start there and work our way outward from that point of view.
I mean, like, as in rules of the game or fundamentals of the movie.
So, I mean, if we're talking about rules between alien and human combat, I think this movie took the spec script. They made it very clear that this was a spec script. They took the Warner Brothers, and that's what gave them I think Tom Cruise insisted on a lot of homage paid to the character, but there were some very serious differences. There were backups, servers, and antennas. You know, it wasn't an alpha, a soldier, a mimic, an alpha, or a omega. So, and there were, and obviously even the doctor, the mechanic was a woman in the manga. I mean, the sergeant was the same, but yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, general, but they paid a lot of homage, right? They also had the exoskeleton. They made in the comic, they both carried axes because they were much better than the guns, which lost ammo and stopped, and the axes just kept going, but you had to learn how to use them. And that's where dying over and over again helps.
So, yeah, you mentioned the melee weapons. There was that, from what I understand, that was bigger in the comics about why she's carrying a sword, other than it looks cool, is because in many of her run-throughs, she kept running out of ammo. And she learned that a sword is sometimes just as good as, you know, a gun. And there comes a point where they decide to take the fight, They need a device, to basically, like, I guess, locate where the Omega is located. So they've got to go get this device from the general.
They made a prototype, and then they end up having to go to the general because they think that's the way they can find the Omega. But the thing is that's what made the movie so interesting. You're operating under one set of assumptions, and you think everything they've done to get to that one set of assumptions, except you find out that it's not that set of assumptions, and they need this thing from the general in order to see where it's truly at. That made the movie, to me, much more interesting than just a Starship Troopers. To your reference, guys, the bugs were smart, but they were, you know, predictably smart. Who did not believe a brain bug was going to show up in that movie? Come on!
I want to clarify that for a moment. If you didn't watch this movie, it's not that they weren't sure how to find the Omega. First off, the whole reason they even know an Omega is because Rita was getting these visions. Whenever you have this reset, eventually over time, as it hones in on you, as the entity, whatever these things are that the Omega controls, if they're all one entity or if the Omega is the entity, I don't know, but would kind of give her these visions where she would see this thing. But he asked her, he's like, oh, so you saw it? And she's like, well, I never saw it. So you're not even sure if this thing even exists. And then he starts getting these visions after enough reboots where it's showing him like this German dam, and they kind of pinpoint where they think it's going to be. And that's where he marches into when he finally decides he's going to do it on his own. And he marches in there to try to take everything out, and he gets to where this thing's supposed to be, and it's not there. So I wasn't sure if they were trying to say, up to the point where they get the device, like, maybe there is no Omega. Maybe this is something that these visions aren't real, or they are a side effect of whatever that's going on. Like, because there's not, you know, the only people who know anything about this reset cycle are Rita, Cage, and the scientist that's helping Rita, because he was there, I guess, with her before, and kind of pieced together a few things with her reboot. So there's not enough people, no one's seen the Omega, if it even truly exists. He goes to where it's supposed to be, and it's not there. So now they're not sure what to do. So they want to go get this device that this scientist made that was taken. The army took it from him and put him into like a mental institution because they thought he was crazy, because they were like, this can't be real. You're just making some garbage here or whatever. So he has to go get it back. And then because it went to the general and because the general had it, wouldn't believe him. And they were going through those cycles where he's like, you won't believe how many times we've had this conversation to try to get it. I wasn't sure up to that point if it's going to turn out that, like, no, there's no Omega, or yes, the Omega is actually not this thing at all. It looks like people now, and it's infiltrated the army, and it's all these. So I wasn't sure if they were going to say, like, he is the mastermind, or if he's working for these Omegas or anything else. Now, none of that is actually what seems to happen in this movie. But even up to the point where he gives them the device, he then, like, calls security on them because they, you know, essentially they didn't break in, but he seems to call security on them. And I was like, is everybody in on this? Like, is this all something where the infiltration's already occurred and this is how they wipe out the last people who fight back? Like, I wasn't sure what they were doing, but it's not. They do get this device, and he stabs it into his leg. And because he has the blood of this entity that's making him go back and forth or whatever in his blood that's making it happen, he now gets a better vision of where the Omega is, which is underneath the Louvre in France.
I am confused on that, though, because the general, like, is convinced by the story. You know, it's going to sound crazy at first when I start telling this, but the further I go on, the more it's going to make sense to you. And then he gives them the device, and then he calls the security on them after they leave the building?
I didn't understand that. Why are they so against the concept? Isn't the, like, again, I'm prior military, and, you know, you watch the movie World War Z, and you think about, you know, the Israeli policy of having the 10th man, the person to always think of the crazy idea. Why were they so against the idea that this enemy they're facing had the ability to do that, and threw everybody in the psych ward when you brought it up?
Yeah, that was a part that just seemed confusing to me. That, like I said, he believed them, it seemed like. Because why would he give the device if he didn't believe them? And then once they leave the building, he calls security on him. But anyway, that leads to a car chase. And then eventually Cage bleeds out and has to get an infusion, a blood infusion, which basically loses the powers. So now we have stakes in the movie. Now, this is it. We have no more resets. And they choose to go.
We think there's no resets. They can't confirm it unless he dies and doesn't come back. So you have, it's almost like when you're, you know, I play, we're talking about video games, I'm playing through Sekiro again, and it's one where you can come back from death once, and then you have to kill a bunch of people to gain the ability to come back from death again, or die completely, but you won't know if you've made that until you get to that point, and then you have to keep trying not to die. So it's got that tenseness of a video game where you're not quite sure if you're really dead or not, so you've got to watch that. So I did like that. I like that they were kind of like, he's pretty sure he can't do it, but why risk it? Let's make it as we're not.
Yeah, and of course, yeah, why risk it? But then he decides to recruit the J Squad to go infiltrate the Louvre and make the attack the night before the invasion. That final scene, that final fight for you guys, did you enjoy that? Did it work for you?
She sacrificed herself for him. That was great. And I mean, you know, he reinvented, you know, I was in preparation of this, I went looking at some conspiracy theories around some different theories of why he did what he did and, you know, the story. And it's definitely, again, I can point out there is a major, major difference in the story, which I honestly don't know which, when reading an honest partaking of each of the story, I think it's called A Time to Kill. When you read each of these different, or kill, again, I got to check up the title in, but it's, in the comic, you know, one of them has to kill on each other permanently. In this story, the Omega reset his time clock way back further, which, and then coincided that with the major phenomenon and every mimic died. Like, so I guess I was a little confused at that. Where did the reset happen? Were they, had they been there earlier? Because there's a time differential that goes into all that, right? So I'm just trying to figure out kind of where that, how that all happened, how he ended up on the helicopter and all the way back to the beginning. That was a little odd.
Oh, you're talking about the end of the movie, which we're not quite there yet for. But yeah. we'll get to that point in a second with our, we'll get to our theories, but the Louvre part, that actual fight, I enjoyed. I liked how pretty much everyone's sacrificing for their run. There's one part in particular where they're on the helicopter, and they describe another one of the rules, which is don't kill an alpha, because if you kill an alpha, they're going to reset this and they'll know what our plan is.
Right.
Yes.
And one of the guys on the helicopter, I forgot who it was, says basically, like, because he starts getting shot at, and like he makes the comment like, oh, no, they know we're coming, right? Implying that this is not their first time doing this. That's actually an homage to the comic, from what I understand, because in the comic, we'll get to the endings and stuff like that, they actually keep, they're still resetting by this point in the comic.
Yeah, yes, because you have to kill one of the antenna. There are two antenna, and you kill, if there's always an antenna open, the server can reset the day. That's what the comic is.
It's more of a technology thing than an alien thing.
No, it's still an alien thing. It's just
it's alien technology.
No, there are aliens. No, there's the aliens are called not mimics, alphas, and omegas. They're called servers, backups, and antenna.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, let's just go right to the end then, guys. So the way this movie ends is they get to the Omega. Cruz basically jumps in the water where the Omega is living and blows him up.
Well, he sacrifices himself.
He sacrifices himself, yeah. And the blood of the Omega goes into his body before he dies, like the Alpha did for him. And then time resets back to when he's on the helicopter going to go meet the general.
Yeah.
In your mind, what happened?
I don't know. That's what I'm being confused about, because I've been reading the backup plans. I'm like, there is some time missing here, and I'm not sure how we jumped. And I'm not sure what does that mean, because all the math has to start mathing, and it's just not mathing for me.
The only thing I could essentially say is that when you do a hero story, the hero has to be the hero. The hero has to make all the right decisions at the end, because that, as the audience, as the reader, you are depending on the hero to show themselves worthy of the title. So in my mind, because things manipulate right back to the point where obviously he would want to be, because he's obviously got feelings now for Emily Blunt. He didn't want her to die. He wants to see what comes out of it. I think he reset to the point where he wanted to be, because he essentially had the power to do so now.
I was hoping, I was hoping that they just blew themselves apart to save the day. And then, you know, you see that the aliens, you know, fall apart and things look good. And then I was fine with that as the ending. I didn't need them to have this thing where he comes back to life. But then when he went back so far, then I was kind of like, wait. Earlier on, when Rita is explaining, you know, kind of how she had it and then lost the power or whatever, it was a trick by them to convince him to come back. So then I was like, oh, is this a further trick? Are the Omegas not the mastermind? Or is it further down? There's an Omega and then there's a Zeta or something underneath that that's managing more things, that's trying to trick them to, like, now they think they're safe and we know not to try this way. Instead, we're going to infiltrate their water systems or whatever. But you don't know that. And I don't think that was what was implied, although I would much more like a dark ending like that. I would have been okay without the coming back. I thought the coming back was cheesy, but if it's going to be for that kind of nefarious thing, which there isn't even like a possible cliffhanger, like, you know, someone doesn't see something and they're like, in the corner of their eye, or there's nothing that makes you think like maybe this isn't just what it actually appears like. Maybe that would have been different, but it was fine for what it is. It's the kind of ending I expect in a movie like this that's a major blockbuster with a real star, but I was hoping for that kind of horror movie style, you know, flash of something that you're like, wait a minute, and then it ends. Like, that would have been great.
Yeah, from what I understand, though, there was an alternate ending to this, and I might save that for later in our episode, but just because we're talking about it now, when I mentioned them being on the helicopter and him saying, like, don't kill an alpha, in the original script that they do kill an alpha. One of the other members of the team gets cornered and has to kill an alpha to save his own life. And he kills one, which resets it. And then they go through it all again. And now they get shot out of the plane and they don't survive. Would you wanted that ending, a little darker ending than what we got? Which, by the way, Tom Cruise wanted this other ending that we saw because it made it like happier, a little nicer.
Right. Yeah, it seems like a Hollywood ending. Yeah.
He is a movie star, so this had to be marketable. So I think the tragic ending is good for an up-and-coming star, but this is still Tom Cruise. So you got to kind of wrap it up and give it a good Tom Cruise style ending. What they didn't want is the heavy sex scenes. They put some of those out. They were in the comic, in the young anime or the young adult, which obviously makes sense because it's young adult stuff.
Yeah, I think essentially the majority of people lean towards happy endings. They just want happy endings. They want it exactly how they see this thing going. You can't break code as you're putting this movie together, because everybody's now fantasizing that he's going to be with Emily Blunt. This has to happen. This has to happen. This is what I'm looking at. This is actually why you've pulled me into this story now, with this B story. And normally the part of the story where the A story and the B story collides is when the story is over with. So I think that they could not divert to something else. Although I am one of those people who loves to give a change of pace endings, and I like to see them as well. So the darker ending would have been fine with me. I'd have just been like Jeremy. I'd be like, oh, cool, this is great, you know, and I'd have moved on and been fine with it. But the majority of people want to see the happy ending. That's why Lifetime is so popular during the holidays. I mean, you basically could see that story coming a mile away, but people look at them till the end. So I think that, you know, it's always a roll of the dice if going with the unexpected ending is the one that everybody wants. Or you go with the popular one just to make sure you make your money back at the box office. So they decided to go with something else, probably where the majority of people wanted to see that type of an ending as opposed to something a little bit darker.
This movie clocks in just under 2 hours. Did you want more, or were you exhausted by the end of this movie all the time? We had all the resets.
I always want more Tom Cruise. I just think he's got every vehicle you put that guy on, even that crazy ass movie Vanilla Sky, every vehicle you put that guy in, you're going to get a good movie. Look, I'm going to be the first dude to say I like Jerry Maguire.
Bro, I think I need to get you just a body pillow of Tom Cruise for Christmas.
That would be not, actually, that may get up on Instagram. I may proudly put that next to me on Instagram and be like, yep, Tom and I are chilling. Happy Merry Christmas. Hashtag winning.
I didn't think this was too long. I was worried at first when I saw the running time that I might be a little long for this type of movie. But again, I am not a big time travel fan, but it's different. This is not really time travel. This is like a day reset. This is Groundhog Day. The rules are followed as well. Like, there's not this weird, again, up until the very end, where you're not quite sure what the ending means. They do seem to follow their own rules of time because it's not time travel. At no point is he going forward in time. He's always going backwards to where he was with nothing else. He wakes up exactly where he was with what he had. The only thing he's got extra is some knowledge of what's going to happen. I'm okay with that. That's you know, if you're going to have a time travel piece of your movie, this is a good way to do it. But I also, I thought this moved fast. You get a lot of time to see him kind of in the build up to where he's becoming, you know, even trying to get off the beach. That doesn't happen for the first hour of this movie. It's him learning, how do I get my first step through the rest of this, right? I really liked the slow build of the beginning, and then it starts moving when he finally is on his, like, you know, I'm not going to reset life, even though it turns out he has. You just don't realize that till he says a few things. That's it moves at a clip at that point. And, you know, I didn't need any more as far as length goes. I didn't think it needed to have anything else. Like I said, you know, I'd like to have seen a kind of darker twinge at the end, or just an abrupt ending. That's what it is. You know, that they saved the day, but now what? Who cares? They stop this thing, move on. But I didn't get bored. I have to stop. I didn't pause it and walk off and do something else, come back. This was a good action movie length, but it also kept everything moving.
Yeah, I agree. I think that the 2-hour window was perfect. If we did an hour and a half, I think we would have missed a lot of details, especially when the adaptations, when you adapt, you know, you're losing a lot in translation anyway. So you're going to have to be at that 2-hour, if not plus, just to make sure that you kind of keep the source material as accurate as possible. So I think 2 hours was like perfect. And it, you know, and like you said, the pacing of it was really well done. Even the midpoint slapping right in the middle, where they do finally get off the beach. And then we have like a new plan saying, okay, now that the stakes are changed and now we see we have a new angle. So let's try to make another plan rather than just surviving and actually figure this thing out. So I think it was well timed and the structure was definitely there.
Yeah, I agree with you guys. This movie didn't really lag at any points. I didn't even realize it was 2 hours long until after I was finished watching it. It paces well. I do like the beach scenes. I mean, it did take him, what, 5-6 minutes to figure out how to turn the safety off on his weapons. And there's some humorous points in there. And it, like I said, it flows. So I want to talk about the effects a little bit for this for the movie. How did you guys feel about the CGI quality, the Exo Squad style mech suits? Overall, how were the effects?
Now that I know there are practical effects for the mech suits, now that I can, I'm watching the movie in homage while we're speaking of it here, because it is Tom Cruise movie. I can see, I'm happy that they did that. The mechs, I mean, the mimics were, I mean, you know, it seems like it was a hard job, but ultimately that character didn't belong in real life. Like, to me, is a hard job is like Lord of the Rings, how they blend all that into what's actually, or, you know, Infinity War, which I think is still the best one, where they blend everything that isn't there with what's real. This one, they did a good job with the aliens. Tom Cruise movie. They didn't screw around. This is going to make some cash.
I liked the mech suits. Again, this is a big budget movie. This is not, I didn't expect, for a recent big budget movie, you know, we're not talking about 1980s RoboCop or something that's like kind of a low budget but kind of worked out. This was a big budget film. It looks like a big budget film. The effects look good. I was not at any point like, ooh. I mean, the mimics look good. You can tell they aren't practical effects for the most part. It's a lot of CG, but it looks good. Like, I didn't have any real complaints. I think there's a lot of things where they move fast enough. They're in dark areas. You don't need to really see a lot of detail. Like, even the Omega, you don't really see a lot of details on that. You know what it is because you see the drawing, like that 3D drawing thing. But other than that, you don't need to see it, and that's okay.
Yeah, I thought the special effects were great. Thought they pulled it off really well.
Yeah, I think that's it. There were a lot of quick cuts, which is a way to get around the CGI issue to make sure it looks good. But overall, it worked because, you know, they were in that almost like a handheld cam feel for the beach fights to give that sort of grittiness to it, which works well with CGI. They didn't spend too much time looking at any one thing. And the fact that they were actually 80-pound actual mechs that they had to wear and walk around with, again, their movements to feel more accurate. Yeah, I think they pulled it off pretty good job.
Look at Maverick. Look at what they did for Maverick when they put him, I mean, even in the first Top Gun movie when they put him in the jets. They did the same damn thing in this movie. You want to be a pilot? Feel what a pilot feels like.
Now, Jeremy, you sort of hinted at it that this is kind of like a time travel movie, and our listeners know that you hate time travel movies, but is this one good enough for you?
Yeah, again, they follow their own rules, and it's not, I don't consider this time traveling. Yes, he's resetting. I mean, I don't consider Groundhog Day a time travel movie. Yes, I guess technically, is a hot dog a sandwich? It's the same kind of discussion. A day reset is okay. The only one that's weird is the very end, because he does go back farther than that original time, and you're not quite sure why it happened. But other than that one, and I think that's on purpose, I think they all make sense, and it's fine. This did not bother me for time travel, because again, it's not him. He doesn't come back with like, oh, and I took this map with me, right? He can memorize a map and draw it out, but he's not coming back with like, oh, I got a gun, or I got this alien weapon, and I give it to everybody. Like, and not everyone believes him, right? It's everyone else doesn't have this reset, and except for Rita and the scientists, no one believes anything about it. I think he's insane if he says stuff like that. So I liked that. I thought this was a good use of time travel, which I'm putting in air quotes that no one can see if you're not on this podcast, because I consider it more of a time reset, and that's different.
Well, that's not time travel.
What if this reset is localized to the planet, or if it's like the whole universe resets?
It has to be the whole universe. Time is a constant everywhere. And you know what? I'm not a scientist, so don't hold me to that. It could be very wrong. I barely understand how toasters work. But I do think that it's a constant throughout the universe. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense.
I agree with that statement, Jeremy. It has to be a kind. The flow of time has to move in one direction. I mean, there can be different rivers, but it has to all go in one direction.
Anyone who knows the movie Edge Tomorrow, it's kind of hard to envision anyone other than Tom Cruise being in this role. However, early in production, there actually was someone else you were thinking about for that role for Bill Cage.
Who is that?
Ryan Gosling.
Never. Let's shoot him down. He's not there. Tom Cruise already owned it. Tom Cruise is like the Optimus Prime. When he gets in a role, no one can follow up.
I have no idea what that means, but...
I think if you went with Gosling, though, you could have that darker ending. You could have that other stuff. You don't need to have him be the Tom Cruise ending where everything works out ultimately, right? I think that would be the only difference. I think he's fine as an action. Like he did the Blade Runner follow-up. He's done other movies that have more of an edge to it. He'd have been fine, but he's not Tom Cruise. You're right. If you're looking for a Tom Cruise movie, you're going to put Tom Cruise in it, period.
I'll be honest. Ryan Gosling has one gear. He can't shift. He just doesn't. And so I think this character that Tom had gave us some depth. Like you say, he wasn't likable in the beginning. He got some likability. Even when he went back to the barracks and he started figuring out how things were going, he was like, he's got the cards. He's going to do that. And only Tom Cruise can kind of do that. You can kind of see when actors have their own kind of an improv going on where you know it's like, you know, Samuel Jackson is the screamer with the curse words. And these guys become their own character. And so when people are casting, unless they're like, Tom drives his movies. He knows what movie he wants to do, so he just does it. But when you're casting and you think about putting people in certain roles, you think of the Samuel Jackson kind of character or the Tom Cruise kind of character or the Denzel kind of character. You know what I mean? So Ryan Gosling was great in Blade Runner because he was a doggone android. He didn't have a lot of character to him, you know, so he was fine how he was, you know.
Spoilers.
Not a lot of emotion.
Which is not a comic, so we have no responsibility on have we spoiled that movie or not.
Oh, that was great. Thank you, Jeremy. That was a good
ending. So, I mean, so he, you know, you just, I don't think he could have pulled it off at all. I really don't.
I agree. I completely agree. This movie, as again, I'm watching it while we're talking. I just think that, to your point, Braxton, this movie works because it is a layered story. And because you get to go through the layers, a movie that typically, any original movie, and I mean that in the sense that the audience doesn't have wild knowledge of the source material, any original movie is a struggle to make some money. It's either going to be hit or miss. And the thing about this movie is, while it wasn't like out the door, it has gotten, it made its money back. And on top of that, it's found new life on streaming services.
It sounds like we all pretty much like this movie or even love this movie, but what could they have done better to take it just that one step further?
I'll go because I think a dark ending would have been a more interesting ending. The other thing, and we didn't really bring this up, the only question I have is when they get the device from the general, why didn't they just jam into his leg immediately? Why didn't they do that right there in the office? There was no reason not to. And then they could have said, hey, man, it's in the Louvre. Why don't you bomb the shit out of the Louvre and we're done. The movie's over. And it would have made sense. Because why wouldn't you? You're going to go there anyway and do stuff. They weren't like, oh, man, we don't want to bomb the Louvre. They were already there. The whole area is a wasteland. Just do stuff. But that's okay. That's the only question I had. But yeah, I think just having that slightly darker ending or not having him come back at all, like literally sacrifice himself. You see everything fall apart. Everyone celebrates and, you know, it moves on. And that would have been fine with me.
I think the Stephen King ending where he dies and comes back in that different time, and we find out that there is another person behind that there is another creature that's sort of at the head of the, because, you know, that's what made Independence Day Resurgence work. Am I right? That's how it got us all to watch that movie. So we got that. So we need that. That would have made the movie, would have made all of it make sense. And I think it would have given us a potential for a second movie.
I think they still left the door open for a second movie. With the ending what it is, you could have the next movie start with a flashback of when he wakes up. And then, you know, then you get that stinger that wasn't there, right? You could do that. But I don't know if this needs a sequel necessarily. I like this as a standalone. It's fine.
They did the anime in 2025. That picked up a couple nods. And actually, what they did in the anime version that came out in 2025 was they blended both the original YA novel and the Edge of Tomorrow story because it was such a good story. It seems like I'm advocating for Tom Cruise. And maybe I am. Maybe I am. I can watch Top Gun Maverick 1,000 times. I think I've actually seen that movie 1,000 times. Again, like, I saw Top Gun when I was in the Navy, so I was in a very pumped up Navy type situation anyway, and they were showing you Top Gun, and you were like, yeah, it was like Rocky for sailors. It just kept you going.
It was just that volleyball scene. That's all everyone likes in that.
You know, it's a thing they throw in there, but I think it was more the jet fighting scenes that were kick-ass.
Sure, it wasn't just playing with the boys on loop? That could be what it was.
It could have been something. Tom Cruise, what are you going to do? If there was a guy, that would be Tom Cruise. He would be shorter than me. I'd have to crouch down.
My favorite part's going to be when Chris edits all of this out.
Braxton, I think you were the only one that had to let us know what you were thinking about. Was there anything you wanted to change in the movie?
No, I was actually pretty good with it. I mean, I was on the fence, like Jeremy, either the dark ending or the regular ending. But for the most part, I think this was a nice change of pace for me with Tom Cruise. Especially it was just coming off of Oblivion. Oblivion was great. And so this was like a little bit of an opposite because, like you say, he wasn't the hero from the beginning. He wasn't well equipped and he had to really build up. And that was different for me for Tom Cruise. The only other thing I can equate his fish out of water story was The Last Samurai. Very similar.
Oh, you know? Such an amazing, probably one of the best pieces of work. I mean, I don't even, can we compare this to Last Samurai? Because that movie was.
Well, just because of him having to get a skill set, he had to develop. He had no clue. He knew how to shoot, but he wasn't.
Yeah, but they were two completely different
kids. So he had to learn.
This guy was all about himself.
Right.
He was all in his own mind. So surface. The other guy was carrying the entire Civil War and all kinds of BS on his shoulders when he was doing that. And I think it was the other way around. I think the samurai saved him. I think that movie like literally just saved his life. And what he ended up becoming was a representation of being saved by the way of the Bushido. Ooh, that was some dope stuff. That needs to be in the after shot.
No. So the only thing I changed in this movie was I would love to know it'd be a little more obvious as to why he went a little bit further back than just pure speculation. Because it's a little jarring. Like, it's like, oh, happy ending. But at the same time, it's like, it's outside the rules that we know that have been established for the rules around this reset thing. Like maybe if they had hinted at maybe like the Omega has their own reset time or something, but because it seems like it seems so much outside the rules we've been given, that's the only thing I think I would love to change.
They could have explained that in the whole repeated scene in the lab where they're talking about the Omega. They could have gotten to that point at some point, explained that time difference.
Yeah, because they used the doctor to be the exposition to kind of glue everything together. So yeah, I agree with you. He could have tossed that in there right now. He could have. Even if it ended at it.
That would, yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. We're not even, see my friend, Braxton's not even putting the bar very high. This is because it's a Tom Cruise movie. We can drop the bar to walk over size. That's all we need. We just need to cover that little hole.
Right.
So do you guys want to see a sequel?
No, I'm going to agree. No.
Yeah, no need. I'd rather not know how it ends.
I hope they don't make Big Trouble in Little China. Did you guys hear that's on the chopping block for sequels? Big Trouble in Little China. They're literally thinking about remaking that
movie. I think it's the wrong analogy, but yeah.
After how badly The Running Man tanked this weekend?
Did The Running Man tank as badly as I thought it would?
It tanked. And so I think they're just worried now with these reboots, you've got to take a box office smash and redo it, because they were talking about like the numbers. They're like, well, the first Running Man really didn't. I mean, we loved, you know, our generation.
It's great.
It's a cult classic. Yeah, so if you're going to remake a cult classic, remake the cult classic. Don't make a brand new movie. That's the problem. You know the reason why Ghostbusters, the remake of the remake, did better than the first one? Take every other scene. You had Spengler at the end, Ghost of Spengler. That was great. But because they took a cult classic and they gave you a cult classic, if you're going to remake a story completely and then you screw it up, you deserve not to make money.
Well, I hate to disappoint you guys. The movie, the sequel is in pre-production right now.
Crap.
Stop. Is it Tom Cruise coming back for the sequel?
Tom Cruise, Emily Blunt, oh, well,
you'll
come
be
back.
There.
Then we're good. Then we're good. So then it doesn't matter what the plot is. It's Tom Cruise.
I kid you not, the working title right now, because, you know, this they'll change when actually release, but it's called Live, Die, Repeat, and Repeat.
No.
That's perfect. That's great. No, I hope it is.
You know that's terrible.
I hope it is. I hope he's holding a little kitten while he's saying it with a new metal jacket and a kitten, because I'll go see that shit first night it comes out. I'll be the second person in line.
And you're going to get a special, you know, popcorn bowl that goes with it.
I will.
It'll be a Mimic's hand
if
for like $80.
If that popcorn bowl refills every time it's full and you get to start the movie again, I'm in.
These things are getting cash, man. I'm telling you.
It's a day-long marathon of the same movie playing over. It's this movie playing 10 times over, resetting at random points.
But then you get a free bowl of popcorn. So it works.
You get a free bowl of popcorn.
Yeah, yeah. And it has to be a fresh bowl every time you come back.
Now, of course, things that are pre-production may or may not ever make it to the big screen. But when it comes to this movie, should people go out and find Edge Tomorrow if they've never seen it?
Yes.
It's yeah, for free, right, on Netflix right now. So if you've got Netflix and you pay that insanely high price, then you'll definitely get it in your queue.
It's free on Netflix until the 30th when it goes off the service. They just put a warning up today.
They're just now, see that. Well, Jeremy, thank you for the additional detail, because I think everyone should go find it on Netflix before they upcharge your plan.
The good news is this will air after that date, so you've missed your window, suckers.
Unless they reset.
True.
Why don't we give this movie a rating? How would you guys rate this movie?
I would rate this a Omega being blown to bits and going 25 days somewhere into the future where I end up in Europe and I'm winning the battle. I would give this a Tom Cruise. Hell yeah. Come on, crowd. Hell yeah. Let's go. You guys can take it from there.
I would actually give it, this was great. I enjoyed this one. I would give it one full thumbs up, but I gave it yesterday.
If I'm trying to stay with a Tom Cruise theme to try to rate this, I would go with my favorite Tom Cruise movie, which is The Last Samurai. And I would give it 4 Bushido blades out of 5.
That's impressive. That's impressive. We're drawing from good history on that one. I'm just going to say that's impressive.
I'd give it a large, comically large helicopter blade as a sword up. It's a fun movie. It's good. You can't
like
go
Blue
wrong
Beetle.
With this.
Cannot go wrong with it. And honestly, you brought in images of Blue Beetle, and that's a good way for this whole thing to end.
So before we head out, guys, do you have any final thoughts on this movie?
Yeah, live, die, repeat.
Was can't that be more profound than that.
So Braxton, thanks for joining us this evening. If people are looking for what you're working on, where can people find you?
Oh, thanks again for having me on, guys. This was a blast talking about one of my favorite Tom Cruise movies and a sci-fi movie. Definitely, I think, kind of jumps into my top 10. If anybody wants to catch up on any of the stuff that I'm doing, sci-fi, fantasy, even my health books, you guys can head over to our publishing company, CosbyMediaProductions.com. You'll get links to our social media, which is on IG, Twitter, and the Facebook. And be on the lookout for some of our new press releases that we have going out. Our newsletter, you can join the newsletter. We've got a lot of great new projects coming out. ANVK working on the sequels to those two comics now. I'm talking about a little bit about Feudal Japan here with the Last Samurai. My duology that's based on the actual character Yusuke is complete, and it'll be coming out in February. So stay tuned for more information on that. It's going to be the historical fiction novel, along with the graphic novel that follows his exploits through feudal Japan, and it's going to be fantastic. So yeah, so you guys can come on out and check us out, follow us on socials.
Awesome. And Jeremy, where can people find you?
I'm here every other week talking about movies with you, but then you can also find me on other weeks on Retrovania, a retro gaming podcast. And of course, as we mentioned in one of our more recent episodes, I'm a member of the band Subtastics, so find everything Subtastics at subtastics.bandcamp.com. We should have a Christmas song out by the time this episode airs.
And Fergal Amayo.
Oh, I'm hard at work trying to get a kid into college. That's its own full-time set of job. I'm also a banger and rebuilding my store as I continue to talk about movies, talk about nerd stuff, get into comics again, start diving into it, working on my own book that I've been working on for the last 6 months, and continuing to manage the process. So I'm just trying not to go crazy, keep a Tom Cruise type cool with a Pierce Brosnan kind of look. How about that? Let's end it. Call it for the day.
You can always find me at All Panel Creations. We're always over there building some piece of nerdy furniture. I want to thank you for spending some time with us this evening. If you think we should keep trying to record this episode over and over and over again, just write us a note, send it over to movie-smash.com, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. This has been Movie Smash with Chris Roberts, Jeremy Parmentier, and Fergal Amayo, produced by me, Chris Roberts, executive produced by Off Panel Creations, LLC. Movie clips provided by the respective studios. You can rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You might even find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for us? Visit us at movie-smash.com and send us a note. It too can be read on a future episode. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Movie Smash wherever you listen to your podcasts.
That was Jeremy trying to put those words in my mouth, and I was putting back. But I did
say
at the
end, depending on how Chris edits this.
I guess I did say at the end it was Tom Cruise. So I mean, if there is anybody I'm gonna take a mic for, it's gonna be Tom Cruise.